I never thought that I was going to have some historical trauma show up. I thought it was all going to be beautiful. I thought it was going to be this magical thing that I was going to learn the language and it was going to be so wonderful. But there comes a lot of hurt with that because people were told not to speak their language. And, you know, people lost that language a lot because they were in fear of what would happen to them if they use the language. So that fear was instilled in them, and they didn't want to teach their children or their children's children to speak the language, because back then you would get your mouth washed out with soap and worse things would happen. I mean, we could go in talking about boarding schools, and that's a whole other subject, but it has been a rewarding and loving journey, but it's also been a very painful journey too.
That was Cheyenne Beatty, and for years, she's wanted to move back home to Eagle, Alaska. It's where everything started for her, her love for culture, language, art, and music. Today, she sits on her property in Eagle, along the Yukon River, and she imagines herself as a young girl, running down the riverbanks with about 20 sled dogs, or trapping marten out at 40 Mile, or walking to school, singing to herself, to ward off any curious wildlife. Reflecting on this, she realized that music has been foundational for so much in her life. It's carried her, and it's protected her. Radio, too. She remembers one Thanksgiving out at 40 Mile. She and her dad were listening to trapline chatter, and they heard her grandparents wishing them a happy Thanksgiving. The reach of radio had made its impression on her. So when she left Eagle, that passion for radio and love for culture, language, art, and music manifested itself in Earth Songs, the radio show she hosted on KMBA in Anchorage. It highlighted Indigenous artists, musicians, and it was the first nationally syndicated show out of the state of Alaska. Cheyenne is in the process of revitalizing her native language, Hanwichin Athabaskan. There are only 4 people left who can speak the language, and she says the process of learning it has been difficult because people have been resistant to teaching her. This is because land, subsistence rights, language, culture, and even children were taken away from her people. So the insistence on guarding these things is understandable. To learn the language, Cheyenne resorted to a more academic setting, mainly through classes. Lately, for about 6 hours a week, she's been working with her aunt to continue learning and documenting the language. Usually they get together and cook, chatting with each other in Hanwichin the whole time. And for all this, she wanted to be back in Eagle, on her traditional lands, to have that sense of place and belonging. Because learning and documenting her culture and life ways is one thing, but it's also about creating a reservoir of culture that future generations can learn from. So here she is, Cheyenne Beatty. Welcome to Chattermarks,
a podcast of the Anchorage Museum,
dedicated to exploring Alaska and the circumpolar north
through the creative and critical thinking of ideas,
past, present, and future.
My name is Cody Liska, and I'll be your host.
Najitahonche Shojre Cheyenne Beatty Iguhuchin. Hi, my name is Cheyenne Beatty. I am Hanwichin Athabaskan from Eagle, Alaska.
And your Athabaskan name means raven whirlwind, right?
Yeah, Chulian Chavaya is a name that I was given. It's a Denana Athabaskan name. And that's what it means, raven whirlwind.
I read that your friend Stephen Hobson gave you that name because you're mischievous, you like shiny things, and because you enter and exit a room like a whirlwind. Do you see yourself as a whirlwind?
Absolutely. I think that I like to come into spaces and take all that's in and then take that and utilize it in other ways where I can share it with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm absorbing a lot of things. But yes, if you've ever met me in person, I'm a little bit over the top.
I wonder if, you know, I'm assuming that's how you were like when you were a kid. Was there a point where you were like, okay, maybe I'm a little too much. And then as you got older, you just embraced it?
No, never.
Okay, okay. That's awesome.
Never too much. Actually, though, what's funny is my ex-husband calls me Kitty Key, which in Denina means too much.
Okay, okay.
So maybe for other people it was too much, but for me, it's just who I am, unapologetically me.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so you recently moved back to your home in Eagle, Alaska. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, what a magical journey this has been. I have to say, a lot of people call me unicorn because I like to manifest things. And for years, I said, I want to go home. I want to go home. The feel of Anchorage just really wasn't the same anymore. And I also felt like I needed to be back on my own traditional lands and have that sense of place. But at the same time, it's a lot to do with language as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are only 4 people that are left that can speak Han Huichin Athabaskan. And that was really important to me. And I really wanted to be immersed in that. And I'm doing actual work with my Aunt Adeline, Junibee Potts, on language revitalization.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I have 20 acres of property. And for many years, my other manifestation is I want to, or I am building a glamping business right now. It's called mm-hmm. Show Off Lee, which in my language means you all be happy. And really, I would say this journey home is at the foundation of my values, which is culture, language, art, music, and all of those things that combine make me who I am is something that I thought, I'm going to build this here in my village.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what does it look like to revitalize a language?
It's so hard. I never thought that I was going to have some historical trauma show up. I thought it was all going to be beautiful. I thought it was going to be this magical thing that I was going to learn the language and it was going to be so wonderful. But there comes a lot of hurt with that because people were told not to speak their language. And, you know, people lost that language a lot because they were in fear of what would happen to them if they use the language. So that fear was instilled in them and they didn't want to teach their children or their children's children to speak the language because back then you would get your mouth washed out with soap and worse things would happen. I mean, we could go in talking about boarding schools and that's a whole other subject, but
mm-hmm.
It has been a rewarding and loving journey, but it's also been a very painful journey too.
You said that originally you set out on this endeavor thinking that it's going to be, you know, this beautiful thing, which it sounds like it is, but there's also that traumatic component. Do you remember what that first traumatic component was?
Oh, definitely. Because everything's been taken away from us, you know, our land had been taken away, our subsistence rights, our children, our language, our culture, just so many things that the people that speak language are very protective of the language, because that's one thing that, you know, they told you not to speak the language, but still it's within inside you. And so being super protective of the language, also when people are starting to try to learn the language, it's inherent in some people to be very critical about the way you speak the language, because it has to be spoken a certain way. And I've learned that very much so. Where I think I'm saying the word right, but they're like, no, like this. And so there's part of that. But then there's also different dialects, and people will talk about, well, that's not how you say it. Or there's just so many levels of it that it was something I didn't expect. And also people being so protective that they didn't even want to teach it to me, even though I was Han and they were Han.
What was that like, trying to get this language out of certain people and they were resistant to it?
I was in shock.
Okay.
I mean, when they said, we don't just teach anybody the language, I was pissed off, because what do you mean you're not going to teach? I mean, you're teaching linguists to take the language and take it out of our village. And then what do we get in return for it? I haven't seen anything that we can utilize. Tons of linguists have been doing that, but I'm Han and you're not going to teach me? That was hard.
So how did you get over that hurdle?
Well, I went to Kolang Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and Han was one of the languages that they were going to be teaching there. So I pursued that because it was in a educational setting with other people, and there was a teacher that guided it, so they would use the speakers. So that was a safe place. I also reached out to other people that were speaking Han and just tried to learn from them. Then I went to Doyon Languages Online, and they have lessons that teach Han. Then the Alaskan Yukon River, or the Yukon Language Center. I'm sorry, yeah, the Yukon Language Center in Canada also has books that have my great uncle Isaac Junaby, who speaks in Han, but that was cassette tapes.
Okay.
So here you had to have these cassettes and then these workbooks. So I've basically reached out to many different avenues to try to learn my language.
Yeah, it sounds like you tried to learn from people around you, and then you resorted to learning Han through academic settings.
Yes.
That's interesting.
Well, I mean, one of the things that is really amazing too is that also the continued learning of these languages. We had the Eagle Village Tribal Council, and people had come together, and we had a 3-day workshop for all of us to learn Han, as many people that wanted to learn it that were Han Wuchin. It's just great because you're guided, and there's somebody there that can help you process certain things between each other. But also, I've been doing language work with other languages as well, like Gwich'in and Koyukon, when I was working at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. And one thing that I think is very important if you're ever going to start a language journey is to have what we had is kind of like a memorandum of understanding, where we all come together and we combined speakers and learners put together something that says, you know, we will treat each other with respect. we'll be listening, you know, things like that.
Yeah. And where are you now in this revitalization process?
I've been working with my Aunt Adeline, and we have been doing about 6 hours of work a week. But lately that has been something we haven't been able to do because I've been gone a month. And what we do is we will come together and we will cook, or we will have, you know, everything is repetitive of greetings to each other. Nitcha Tahonche is just like, how are you doing? And so I would respond to that. And then we do activities that are pretty much the same all the time. Liji Ni Thun is, you know, do you want tea? That's something that you always start with. Everybody has tea and then you start speaking.
You know, I'm thinking about you moving back to Eagle, and I wonder if you've had any moments of deja vu since you've moved back, maybe a situation that brought you right back to your childhood.
Oh my gosh, all the time.
Okay.
But one thing in particular is that I'm sitting here and I have my own company called Chukan, which means Yukon River in my language. Mm-hmm. And I'm using Starlink to work with my clients.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting on this side of the river, of the Yukon River, and I look out my window, and right across the Yukon River is where I used to live. We were the only family that lived on the other side of the Yukon River. Mm-hmm. And I just see me as a young girl of about 6 or 7 running down the Yukon River banks with about 20 sled dogs, thinking that I would never necessarily be here at this moment doing what I'm doing from that tiny little girl. If I could told her that these things would be happening to me now, I don't think she would ever believe me. But, you know, growing up as that little girl here made me into the person I am today. And
yeah,
I, you know, we lived a subsistence lifestyle. We didn't have running water or electricity. You know, we had to make a garden. We had to, I was out trapping with my dad in the 40-mile country when he was trapping marten. Mm-hmm. Also, I was traveling with him and my mother when he became the first park ranger of the Yukon National Charlie Preserve. And so my foundations of what I'm doing today were born from that little girl. It instilled values in me that I carried on until this day, on, you know, respecting land, respecting others, listening to your elders. I mean, even things like this that are probably people don't think about, but conserving water is huge. I mean, thinking about how you have to chop a hole in the ice, go down, fill up a bucket, and then go up, you know, to your house and fill another huge, you know, bucket up full of water. It really just makes you appreciate things. And when people just have things so freely and easily, they don't even think about that. I mean, we used to have to, when I was young, when we lived across the river, I used to have to walk across the river and to get to school. And by myself when I was really young, and I'm all thinking, what if wolves came? I could have died. And like, my parents' questionable decisions are like, what? But, you know, I walked all the way across the river, and then I would walk to school and by myself. Then I'm thinking, people don't let their kids do stuff like that anymore. And then also when the river broke up, I'd have to stay with the family, and I was separated from my parents. There was a lot of sacrifices you had to make when you're growing up on this lifestyle, but man, did it make you a very well-rounded person, and also to appreciate the smallest things and be kind.
When you moved to Anchorage, how did you feel about the accessibility of so many things that were not accessible in Eagle?
Well, I mean, it wasn't like a culture shock because every year we did leave to go to Ohio, right side out of Cleveland. So it's not like I was like, oh my gosh. But, you know, I loved Anchorage because first of all, this place in Eagle, it was not big enough for my personality.
Okay.
Fairbanks was not a big enough for my personality. So Anchorage had to be what I went to. And then, you know, when I got there, I became a on-air personality at 90.3 KNBA. And that,
yeah.
I mean, they used to pay me a quarter to shut up for 5 minutes here. Now I could tell them. I could tell them they pay me big money not to shut up.
Yeah.
So it was awesome. And I loved having a phone. I loved electricity. I loved running water, flush toilet.
Yeah. And at KMBA, that's where you began hosting Earth Songs, right?
Yes. I was the host and producer of Earth Songs, which was an hour-long program that highlighted indigenous artists, musicians, and it was the first nationally syndicated show out of the state of Alaska.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you spent a lot of time sharing Native music and interviewing Native people on the radio on Earth Songs.
Yes.
What have you seen it accomplish? You know, getting that music and those voices out there into the world.
Well, I mean, the whole point of Quantic in the first place was to have a radio station in an urban place. It's the only urban Native radio station at that time in the country. And it was to get Indigenous voices out, because during that time, that was when people were, I mean, really just having very cruel and devaluing things in the media about Alaska Native people. And we wanted to be able to tell our own stories and be able to share our culture. You know, Alaska Native cultures and languages, there's about 21 different languages within the state of Alaska. There's mm-hmm. half of the tribes throughout the nation in the state of Alaska. And we are a rich and vibrant people from all regions, and it was our turn to be able to highlight who we are and our cultures, art, and music, and language, instead of what people are stereotyping us as.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think that the work that you were doing on Earth Songs help expand people's minds, help them get away from that negativity and that bigotry?
Yeah, because, you know, the best thing that you can do, people don't want to hear you preach at them and talk about stuff, but people love music. Everybody loves music. Mm-hmm. So here you're listening to this amazing music, and my job was basically to take the artists and say, what are you talking about in this song? What does it mean? And it really did open people's eyes. I mean, a lot of the times they would be just listening to music and they'd like it. They'd like the tune, the melody, or whatever. But then we had the deeper, you know, understanding of, you know, not only what they're saying, but the instruments that are in it and the traditional instruments and the community that is being built around it. There's just so many different levels and layers mm-hmm. that comes with music, especially for Indigenous people. A lot of the times, if you're trying to have a conversation about certain things when it comes to culture, they check out, you know, because you never know how you're communicating. However, music can just do that. Music is medicine for the soul and for the mind.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a song that has helped you in one way or another throughout your life?
Oh my gosh, I have so many. I was like,
okay.
when the first thing though that came to mind was Robbie Robertson, "The Sound Is Fading." I absolutely love Robbie Robertson. Rest in peace, Robbie. Love him. And that's from the Underworld of Red Boy album. And the other is, if I always said that I could, that Stevie Nicks could send me a therapist's bill, because how many times I've gotten through a lot of things because of her.
Yeah.
There's just, it depends on what day, what mood, but, you know, even the greats like Johnny Cash and Patsy Cline, I mean,
yeah,
it depends on what happened to me that day.
Do you remember a time, or maybe the first time, that you found yourself going to music, you know, in a difficult time?
I'd say from like birth, basically, you know, because I've always been musically inclined and I'd sing all the time. I'm actually a singer.
Yeah.
People used to say, how do you learn to sing so good? And I'm like, my dad told me, as I said, I was walking across the Yukon River when it's frozen out, but I also was walking like over a mile to school. And, you know, there's nothing around except for my house from where I went to where I'm going to go to school. So that's all wilderness. Mm-hmm. So my dad said, sing really loud so that you know, bears know that you're around and that you're not just startling them out of the blue. So I used to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow on the way to school, and I made it there live every day.
Yeah. Oh, that is so perfect, because you started singing as a form of protection.
You know, I never thought about that. Wow. It's kind of a little epiphany here. Thanks, Cody.
You're welcome. I do what I can.
Wow.
What do you make of that?
I never really thought about that. And you know what? That's like kind of the perfect foundation for my whole life, because music has gotten me through so many things. And it's also just carried my career. Wow. I'm going to have to take that in for a moment. Huh. Yeah, I'd say that a lot of things have grown from the foundation of that very statement.
Out of all the things you helped shine a light on through Earth Songs, are you proud of any in particular?
Oh, gosh, I'm so proud of so many things. I mean, well, as I said about Robbie Robertson, he was my great white buffalo. He's the one and only person I didn't really get to interview. I interviewed Buffy St. Marie. And pretty much if anybody's ever watched Rumble, Indians Who Rock the World, pretty much everybody in there I've interviewed. Mm-hmm. I've collaborated with some of these exact artists, and I've actually sing on some of their own albums. So really a sense of community and connection and sharing language between each other, being able to have a platform for people to talk about difficult situations, things that were happening throughout history and also in the present at the time, and being able to connect people into community at the Native American Music Awards, which I've presented at. And I met some great people. Like, I met John Trudell so many times and interviewed him. And just, I've had the most amazing moments. And, you know, I met, you know, Felipe Rose from the Village People, and they're just so many different people that you don't even think about that are in, you know, there's Redbone and just so many different people that have shaped music. And I got to be there to have conversations with these people and also see them influence other artists and how it really grows and keeps building upon itself. And seeing young artists be inspired.
Have you had any moments where you're a little nervous to do the interview, or are you the type of person, because I'm like this, where I am confident in my abilities as a researcher and then as a writer, you know, writing the questions, reading the questions, making sure that I've done my job to be able to feel comfortable enough to interview anybody?
I guess there's one person. It was Brandi Carlile.
Okay.
I loved Brandi Carlile so very much. And this is before she was like really, really big. And we started playing. I remember the album we first started playing of her. She was so young at the time. And then the second album came and I really loved it. And then I was like, oh my gosh, Brandi Carlile's coming to Alaska. I'm going to interview her. She's going to be on my show. Mm-hmm. And so I'm all like, be cool. So we had to go get her at the Westmark and with the Hansroth brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like trying to be cool and just be chill and whatnot. And we get her, we go to the studio, we're sitting down, we start talking, and I'm all like, tell me about the experience that you had when you first met Elton John. And she's like, oh my gosh, I was so freaking out. So basically she's saying everything that I was in. And I told her, and I go, that's funny. That's exactly what I felt like when I saw you today and I was going to interview you. She goes, that's funny. I never thought that, because when I walked out, I saw this badass bitch standing there.
Yeah.
And I would never think that you would be somebody that would be afraid to talk to me. And I was like,
yeah,
everybody heard that on 90.3 KNBA. Thank you. Brandi said that.
You know, what's great about that question is it's a smart question. You know, you looked at yourself and you're like, okay, I'm kind of freaking out about this interview. So I want to see if she has maybe had this same experience. And I bet you, I'm just guessing, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong, but I bet you it felt like a weight was just lifted off your shoulder, and then you're like, all right, now it's time to do my job.
I wasn't really like scared or anything that like, okay, so much. It was like, it's kind of like when meeting her was a different thing about being kind of scared. But once you get into my studio, you're in my studio now. Mm-hmm. This is my lair. You know? And it's also where I'm like really comfortable. Like most of my interviews that I've had with people are like, this has been like one of my best interviews. It was like talking to a girlfriend. I'm like, I'll be your girlfriend anytime.
Have any of your interviews, you know, resulted in, you know, long time communication or even friendship?
Well, Brandi was for a while. I mean, she would bring her dad up and her brother up, and I'd always bring them fish. And she never did come to my wedding at the time, but I invited her. And she, you know, basically every time would come through town, we'd spend, you know, just a tiny bit of time, like, talking. But I'm trying to think of other people that I guess a lot of the indigenous artists that I was on Earth Songs, they become really, really good friends. Like for instance, there was this guy or this band or person called Frozen Whitefish, and now that's Mike McIntyre, and now he's like a really amazing artist, and he makes these completely amazing masks. And so,
okay, yeah,
you know, watching the growth of somebody also going from music to art is pretty amazing.
Thank you. Can you think of any of your songs that came about as a result of an emotional situation or event, you know, either happy or sad?
Yes. There's a song actually currently that my aunt and I are working on, and it is all in the Han Wuchin language, and it's basically how we are mourning for our King Salmon. We used to have about, sometimes they could get 600 King Salmon, King Chum dog salmon, and a fish wheel a day. And my family and another family would share these fish between each other to feed our families, but also feed our dog teams when everybody had dogs. Mm-hmm. We are lucky if we can even have two in a year of King Salmon. And also, you know, we're going to get arrested if we try to harvest that salmon too. And so, yeah, I'd say this song specifically is the most emotional song. And it's basically me asking Creator or, you know, whoever's to watch over us and please bring our salmon back, because we're crying by the banks of the river and we're mourning for them and we miss them and we want them to come home.
Mm-hmm. Having lived that subsistence lifestyle and lived the way that you have lived with your culture, your heritage, do you think that that informed you as an interviewer?
Absolutely, because the way that Indigenous people around the world carry on culture, as well as teachings and language, and is through stories. Mm-hmm. That's how we tell, you know, the next generation. You know, there's also stories that teach our kids. They're specific. They're basically ways that we tell a story about something so that, you know, a child doesn't cry while out hunting, or
yeah,
like the stupid boy stories are kind of things that they're doing that they shouldn't be doing, and you're trying to learn a lesson from that. Mm-hmm. Also stories of our past and different things that we are supposed to pass down throughout the years, our traditional place names. There's just a variety of things that I would say really come through when we tell stories. And so I'd say that learning that, I was prepared to just have, honestly, I wouldn't even say it's interviewing a lot of times. It's just having a conversation with somebody, the Ji Thou Ni Thun, like you're sitting down for hot tea.
Yeah. I think talking to people for a living, you know, about their lives, their heritage, their struggles, their triumphs, all of that can really take its toll on you. Did you find that to be true for yourself?
Yes and no. I mean, I have a gift when it comes to communicating with people, and it also opens me up to a lot of people and a lot of their own pain, and I listen. But also at the same time, it teaches me valuable lessons, and the way people share their stories and their culture and their art and their music and who they are as a people is so enriching. And I've been traveling the world for a long time. I went to Australia for a month, and being able to share a story with people there, and also going throughout Europe to like also meet Sami people and the Greenlandic people and talk about, you know, how we're fighting for our right to stay cold as climate change is happening to us. There's just so many wonderful ways that we're able to communicate with each other and learn from each other. And it's very enriching and wonderful to be able to have the opportunity to do that with people around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I listened to this podcast with you, this podcast interview with you, and you said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that wherever you go, wherever you travel to, you'll find indigenous people fighting for their traditions and their way of life.
That's true. Because it's been, pretty much every indigenous culture around the world, people have tried to take things from us, and we are still here and we're still strong. And actually, I feel like we're stronger than we ever were. The next generation is breaking barriers. I mean, you can see that in my niece, Quanah Chasing Horse. You can see mm-hmm. that in Lily Gladstone. Mm-hmm. You can see that with the Osage performing recently at the Oscars. Mm-hmm. You have never seen that before. And our representation of us as indigenous people is growing, and there is a movement, and we are coming from a place where at one point you weren't proud to be Native because of the atrocities that were happening upon people across the world. But I'm specifically going to be talking about us as Alaska Native people, mm-hmm. specifically us Athabascans that, have been ashamed through our culture and our language. Now look at their great grandkids, or even their own grandkids, are knocking down doors and standing up and advocating, and it's a whole different era.
Yeah.
And so people better just watch out, because we're coming.
Yeah. What do you think it means for an Alaska Native person to struggle with their identity?
Oh, I think that that's a question even for just anybody struggling with their identity. However, I have to say, at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, what I thought was so beautiful was we all struggle with our own identity, no matter where you come from, no matter what your background is. Mm-hmm. However, seeing people and our youth learn more about who they are, and their ancestors and their ways of life for thousands of years, created such a strong foundation of who they are and brought such confidence within them that I've really seen the growth of that and finding your identity and how powerful that is, and just makes you into this confident person. And then when you're the best version of yourself, that radiates to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you struggled with your identity at all?
I say the only identity I think I struggle with is my Scots-Irish side, because I don't know very much about it.
Okay.
But because I grew up here, I think inherently it just kind of was a part of me. The only thing I would say I'd really struggled with was that when the gold rush happened on the Klondike, so the Han Nation is here in Eagle as the Han Wichin, mm-hmm. but then mm-hmm. I'm also Trondek Wichin from Moosehide Yukon Territory near Dawson City. So the border was put between our nation. I'm both of both. Okay. And Eagle is a very historical place. It's where they had constructed Fort Egbert. This is because the gold rush was happening during that time. Mm-hmm. And there's a first judicial district here in Eagle, Alaska. Well, our chief saw that there was a large amount of people that are about to flood into our territory. And so he took our songs and our dances and he gifted it to Tana Cross. And the one thing I would say that I didn't learn growing up is really any of our songs or dances, because they were given for safekeeping, and now we need to bring them home. Mm-hmm. And also, not being able to speak language during that time because of people fearing for us what would happen to us once we went out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say we struggled. I'd struggle at the very beginning because these things were kept from me, but now they're being brought back.
Did anything kind of alleviate the feeling of that being a struggle?
I guess I didn't really know really it was a struggle as much as when I started working at the Alaska Native Heritage Center the very first year was open, and my heart was broken because they had a dance group there that were singing their songs and their dances, and I ended up crying because I didn't have that, and that's kind of when it opened the floodgates for me.
And what was your next step?
I just started learning more about, I didn't even know that there were 11 different Athabascan cultures. I mean, the Heritage Center opened doors for me and in my heart, in my mind, in so many ways. And I just really started learning and getting education about that and learning about cultural items that were in the Heritage Center's collection.
Mm-hmm.
Which led me to really wanting to learn more about taking care of these sacred objects or collections that really tell the story of who we are as a people, mm-hmm. which eventually led me to working at the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
Mm-hmm. And what was that like?
Oh my gosh, it was so amazing. I got to go there and work on helping them do the Northwest Coast Hall, which was a hall that opened the American Museum of Natural History well over 100 years ago. And so I got to work on conservation of these amazing collections from all over the Northwest Coast. And here I'm like doing conservation work. Like, I'm like, oh my gosh, this dust is over 100 years old. If we could just look at it under a microscope and like what stories it could even tell about where it's from and what, you know, it was awesome. It was a really awesome experience. And again, here I am, this little girl running around with 20 dogs, you know, and some of them, I mean, I think there were possibly, you know, some that had part wolf in them. I think one of them did. I would always laugh. They'd call me Wolf Girl as I'm like running along the banks of the Yukon River. Yeah. And now here I am in New York City working at one of the most prestigious museums. And I thought, God, you've come a long way, girl.
Yeah. How often were you thinking about that, you know, about that little girl along the Yukon River, you know, just living your life out there and then where you were at that point in that museum?
Oh, I thought about her a lot. You know, she was so inquisitive and, you know, back then, of course, we didn't have loads of information being fed to us like we do these days. And so I'd have all these just little magical adventures all the time and take myself to different places when you read books and also radio. I mean, I got into radio probably because I listened to radio. That was kind of my lifeline to the outside world. And my imagination went so many different places.
Yeah. That's interesting what you said about it was your lifeline to the outside world. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, that was the only form of entertainment in the household. So I would listen to what my parents listened to. My thing was they had Casper the Friendly Ghost that they would play on the radio. And so that was so cool for me. I mean, we didn't have television. And then when we worked, or when we trapped out on the 40 mile for Martin, there was KJNP's Trapline Chatter, which I thought was so cool because my grandparents in Cleveland, Ohio could call KJNP and then they could give us a message. We were out on the 40 mile one year during Thanksgiving and we're listening and we're in this tiny, tiny cabin. It's so cold. And I think I was like 5, and we're just listening to the radio and music, and then Trapline Chatter came on, and to hear that my grandparents could tell us Happy Thanksgiving to us in the middle of nowhere, all the way from Cleveland, Ohio, blew my 5-year-old mind.
I bet. It's still kind of crazy to think about.
Right? So radio really just, like, I think I just fell in love with radio at such a young age that it made sense for me to get into radio. I mean, I had my own little radio show that I would co-host with my wheel dog, Hunter. Mm-hmm. But I always used to laugh and say, well, he didn't contribute very much, so I fired him.
So were you going into the studio, or did you have a handheld recorder that you were doing this with?
For Earth Songs?
No, not Earth Songs. The show with your dog.
Oh, no, we would just, it'd be like, you know, your role played outside talking about stuff. And okay. I would like pick up on stuff that I turn on the radio. So I would just talk to him.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, it really sounds like you manifested all of that.
I did. I mean, I never thought about it back then. I mean, I don't think the word manifesting was a thing, but I mean, I'm doing it now. Yeah. Literally, I'm doing it. There's just been so many things that I said, I'm going to do this, and this is going to happen, and it has. And it continues to happen for me. And it's basically the universe telling me that I'm exactly where I need to be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, because I'm an overachiever, I get down on myself, like I'm not doing things fast enough. But I also have to remember, no, you're doing things in the exact time that they need to be done and no more.
Yeah, definitely. And then if you look at the quality of the things that you're doing and then the frequency, that always helps me, you know, because I think that I, like you, am a little bit of a workaholic. And if I pause for a moment and then look at the things that I'm doing and then just kind of stack them up really quick, then that maybe puts my mind at ease a bit, because there's like a physical representation of the work. And I'm like, okay. And then, you know, I move on.
Yeah. So what I do is I make lists, and then It's like it's on a whiteboard. I make a list, and then as I do everything, I cross it all off. And once I've crossed everything out, I take a picture and I put it in my phone, and then I wipe the whiteboard. So then later, when I'm feeling like I haven't done enough, I'll look at those things. But I also need to remind myself that once I'm doing things and working on it, that I need to take a moment also to be happy, mm-hmm. recognize and acknowledge that I did it, and not just move on to the next thing before I have accepted, acknowledged, and appreciated it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really great technique. What's on your list right now?
So many things. Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, obviously I'm trying to build my glamping business, Show Authly. I mean, eventually I want to do a YouTube channel to talk about Alaska Native culture, language, art, music. Mm-hmm. I also want to do a product line that I'm going to be doing when it incorporates my language. It also incorporates a lot of who I am, as well as my family. And I would say that Show Authly is really my brand, because everything I'm doing is about you being happy, mm-hmm. or about other people being happy. And I kind of came to that one day when I was just sitting there talking to a friend, because they're like, I love everything that you post about, you know, your positivity and mm-hmm. your language and your culture and the things that you say. I mean, there's been people that have said, you know, you've gotten me through some days, and you never really know how much you're impacting somebody when you're just putting things out there. But some mm-hmm. people will call you up and said, you know, I was having a really hard day today, and I read what you wrote and it just really resonated with me, and thank you.
Yeah.
And so I just continue to do it and just hope that it helps whoever that day, or that they share it with others. And literally, you know, my whole essence of who I am is really, I just want people to be happy, and yeah. I want to build blocks and make connections and grow foundation and just connect with people and make sure they're okay. Cause it's been pretty hard the last couple of years, and check in with people, make sure they're okay. And listen, sometimes you don't have to give any advice. You don't have to really talk that much, but people just want you to listen to them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this argument that I've read and that I've heard against the word preserve, that if something is being preserved, then that thing is ancient and unchanging rather than what it is, a living culture and a living heritage that is still growing and evolving. What do you think about that?
I think we use the word perpetuate certain times. I think that I get what they're saying about preserving, because, you know, I'm going to go back to the Heritage Center again. Obviously, I love that place. The Alaska Native Heritage said they are a living cultural museum. We're not preserving anything. We're sharing things. You know, we're sharing our language, culture, music, art, and traditions. And so we're not preserving anything. We're passing it along. We're keeping it going. And so I see why people would be upset with that word.
How about the word village to describe an Alaska Native community? Is that word outdated?
Heck no. I live in the village.
Okay. Okay.
I love, I think maybe it's outdated because there's so many people like moving out of these places that there is no more of a village anymore. Maybe that's part of the thought of it being outdated, is unfortunately there's so many people out doing out migration from these places that they become just very few people. And so, but also a village has a big definition of community, and sometimes I don't think that you have a sense of community as much anymore because of when technology showed up here. A lot of people kind of isolated each other. For us, we do get together through many different activities throughout the year, but I know that there are other places in rural Alaska that probably are feeling that pain.
What do you mean by that? That when technology showed up, people started to isolate.
They weren't talking to each other anymore. There wasn't as many activities. I mean, people started getting satellite. Then you are in a state of, well, the Hatfields and McCoys are the kind of that whole idea of like, I want more, I deserve more.
Keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah. So personally, I've watched technology show up and destroy the sense of community at this place. I mean, when we just had, you know, VHF, CBs and whatnot and radio, people, we all came together, you know, we watched the black and white films on the reel to reel. We would get together down at Ford Lake and the parents would hang out and the kids would play and we'd all bring food. We used to have house party, which is not what people think of a house party. House party back then was that the men and women and like families would show up and they would help build somebody's house. Okay. And women would bring food and the kids would play. And then everybody was building somebody's house. They don't do that anymore.
So there was work involved.
Oh, yeah, they're building a house. People are like, and they're all hanging out. It was part of the being part of the community.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so many amazing things that I was just talking to one of my friends and he and I were just kind of reminiscing, and we continue to reminisce about, remember when? I mean, I always feel like I should write a song because we always say that. Remember when? Remember when we did that? Remember when we did that?
Yeah.
And it's constant all the time because we all miss that real sense of community. And, you know, the biggest, greatest thing is for the 4th of July every year, we all come back together and we, it's like the biggest like reunion. Now, not only do, you know, my crew come back together, but then they have their kids or their grandkids that come back. And so now we're gaining that community back, even just for that few days.
And that takes the whole community. Everybody has to be involved for it to work.
I'm going to refer to ANVC as where it takes a village.
Yeah. Yeah. I read an article about you on the Athabascan Woman blog, and there's this part where you talk about the benefits of living a healthy lifestyle, how having a healthy mind, body, and spirit helps you attain your goals.
Yes, absolutely. I'm doing that here. I love it. For those of you that know me for a long time, you won't believe that I'm going to bed at like 8 o'clock.
Do you stay up late normally?
Oh man, in Anchorage, I mean, I was on the radio and I was like the party girl and I was at all the festivals, you know? And I was the night owl. Now I'm a morning person. Look at how cute that is.
It happens.
From night to morning. It does. But yeah, I go to bed early now and then like I'll wake up early and I like do Pilates and do some strength training and greet my day. And I just have the most beautiful view of the Yukon River and, you know, eating moose meat and caribou and it's just wonder and like at the, you know, then I'll go walking and I just love walking here because I mean, like I could be walking for 40 minutes. I could see one car maybe, if that, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's pretty amazing being here and I absolutely love it. I'm going to have to hold on. I'm going to have to come back. I got to grab something.
Yeah, for sure.
Sorry. Sometimes when you live in a small community, if people go to the post office, they'll get your mail and drop it off. I heard the snow machine pull up.
Oh, you did? Okay, that's what that was.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. You know, I really like this quote of yours. I read, again, on the Athabascan Woman blog. You say that music, culture, language, and tradition, that's my passion, my life, what's important to me. If money was important to me, I wouldn't volunteer for anything. That's not my focus. I wonder if you feel like all this work you've done, elevating Native voices and experiences, is that something more than just a job, just a career? Is it something more akin to a calling?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like I said, that little girl growing up across the river, everything she did really laid out the foundation of who I am as a person today and also what guides me in the values that I lead my life with. And it just makes me a whole person to do all of those things because that's what my love language is.
Well, Cheyenne, those are all the questions I have for you. I want to thank you for talking with me today and for all the work you've done over the years and also the work that you continue to do today.
Masichoshicha, which means thank you very much, my friend. Jukdrin Hozo. Have a good day.
Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I guess I just hope that people continue to be very proud of who they are as Indigenous people and share their voices, because it's important not only for us to learn more about your traditions, music, art, and culture and language, but it's a foundation that strengthens our next generation to be effective in spreading Indigenous voices across the world.
For more information about the Anchorage Museum, visit anchoragemuseum.org. This podcast was produced by me, Cody Liska, for the Anchorage Museum, with additional help from Julie Decker. Chattermark's music is produced by Keys Open Doors.